Thank you for joining me on UCSD Guestbook. This evening, it is my pleasure to welcome Sidney Brenner, who recently delivered the three Kuffler lectures, which he entitled From Genes to Brains and Back Again. Welcome, Sidney. You have had at least three different scientific careers, in each of which you have had a profound impact on the study of biology. First, as one of the creators of the field of molecular biology. Second, as the initiator of an extraordinary program in developmental biology. And most recently, launching the new field of genomics. It was most impressive to hear your three lectures. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what led you down this path into biological research. Were there key aspects of your education, for example, that prompted you in this direction?
Well, I grew up in a country which wasn't renowned for scientific progress. It was South Africa. And I became very interested in nature as a child. And I think, like most children, are interested in nature. But in fact, I had decided that nature would be worthwhile looking into a little more deeply than just admiring it from the outside. And fortunately for me, there was, owing to the great Carnegie Endowment, there was a public library in my hometown, which was a small town just outside Johannesburg. And since I taught myself to read when I was very young, I went to the library and managed to get myself promoted to the adult library when I was about eight. And in this, I found a remarkable book called The Science of Life by Wells and Huxley. I actually ultimately stole the copy of the book from the library, but I've lost it now. And what I have now is I've been able to buy copies of this book. This was the most incredible book I'd ever read, because it told you everything about biology. It hasn't been reprinted, but that's where I learnt about this. And so I started my own laboratory when I was about nine, but also by reading another book called The Young Chemist by Sherwood Taylor, which again I found in the library. And again I did, but this one I did not steal. I didn't steal it. I started to do these experiments, and they had nothing to do with what I was taught in school. But ever since that time, I've always prided myself on being self-educated. And in fact, if ever I want to learn a new subject, I just start again with a book. So it was books that brought me to this, and the opportunity through a library to have these books. Of course, today nobody reads anymore, so I don't think this kind of influence will be very common in the future. I think for most young people nowadays want a course in it. They have to go to a course because they feel you can't teach yourself. But I think the idea of being self-taught is something that stayed with me all my life.
Molecular biology, your early field of interest, dealt with big questions in the early days when you and a few friends were really breaking the ground in this field. DNA, of course, carries the code or the blueprint that instructs the formation of proteins of which all organisms are made, and you deciphered the code by which DNA is translated into protein, and later went on to prove the existence of messenger RNA as the intermediate between DNA and protein. What are the big questions in molecular biology today?
Well, someone once said, and I've been unable to trace this quotation. In fact, I think it was a mathematician who wrote this. And in fact, I've even called up the mathematician and asked him whether he ever wrote it, and he said he didn't. So I don't know where I read it now, and perhaps I invented it. But it says that in science, most problems are never solved. That is, most questions are never answered. They just disappear. Mm. And so the big questions that we asked in those days, many of them, of course, are solved, but many of them just disappeared. Hmm. For example, I can remember a question that was asked in embryology in the 60s about cell differentiation. And the question that was asked was the following: was it a state or a process? Hmm. I mean, this was thought to be a very significant thing. Now, today, when we quote that, it just sounds mad that one should be asking such questions. So I think the big questions that are being asked today is, given the complexity of biological organisms, given that they are produced in this long period of evolution, starting with very simple ones, and given our capacity now to extract data from the living world, how are we ever going to put this together and understand it? Mm-hmm. Will it forever remain a kind of telephone directory? We don't even have the yellow pages at the moment. So I think those are the big questions mm-hmm. that people are grappling with. Mm-hmm. It's to try to understand the connection between the various levels of organization in biology mm-hmm. in order that we could have a grasp of it.
One way in which to make the connection between genes and their function and their integrated action in the organism is through the study of development. And you raised the diminutive and lowly nematode worm, Caenorhabditis elegans, out of obscurity and made it one of the most useful and productive systems for the study of developmental questions. We recognize now that it's remarkable that across a wide range of organisms, the processes of patterning and segmentation and differentiation are often held in common as one goes from one animal to the next. Has the study of development largely unfolded the way you thought it would when you first launched this program?
Well, when I first launched this program, it seemed hopeless to even contemplate that we'd get down to the molecular level so quickly. In fact, this program was launched with the idea that what we needed to do was to try and explain it at the cellular level. There was a lot of activity at the time in coupling genes directly to behavior. Mm-hmm. People wanted to have this direct relationship. In fact, it was a very, if you remember, it was a very controversial issue as to whether genes did determine behavior. Mm-hmm. But they do indirectly in the following way: that what genes do is they carry the instructions to build nervous systems. And what nervous systems do is to generate behavior. So it seemed to me at the time that the problem need to be divided. And that first we had the question is, how do genes specify neurons, specify neuronal connections? And then as a quite separate problem, how do these assembly of cells interact to produce the behavior. And what seemed to be the key thing in the middle, the meat, so to speak, was in fact the anatomy. Now, of course, anatomy was a kind of old hat subject. No one confessed they did anatomy. But I did remember a saying of a friend of mine, Francis Crick: when you can't study function, do the best next thing, which is to study structure. And so the idea of finding the wiring diagram, as it became loosely called, the way the genes specify the wiring diagram, and the way the wiring diagram generates behavior, then became the kind of manifesto, if I can call it, of mm-hmm. that work. Mm-hmm. Of course, at the same time, we wanted to know what do the genes do in order to do this, so to speak. People talk loosely about the function of the genes, but those are not the functioning entities. The functioning entities in organisms are cells. And so our problem became is how do genes get hold of cells, so to speak, and direct them or interact to give us mm-hmm. these, in the case of C. elegans, this exquisitely specified plan. Mm-hmm. So first we decided we would do the plan. That actually took more than 20 years to do and resulted in one paper published in a rather obscure journal called Philosophical mm-hmm. Transactions of the Royal Society. Mm-hmm. But I think did do this. It was important to do it completely mm-hmm. because with all things, when you try to explain a complicated structure, there's always the skeptic in the audience who says, how do you know there isn't another wire that goes up the back of the animal and descends and does this? And of course, we wanted to be able to reply, there are no other wires. We know all the wires. So hence, the idea of doing things completely became necessary in order to try to perform the groundwork for this explanation.
And one of the remarkable things about the nematode, of course, is the fact that there really are only 900 and some cells in the organism. So one has the opportunity to get the complete solution to that problem. As you moved on to the sequencing of the genome of C. elegans, this took much less time and has only recently been completed, but it was, I guess, the work of a much briefer period.
Yes, well, I think, of course, if you look at the history of sequencing, which was invented essentially by a colleague of mine, Fred Sanger. Fred, we discovered, liked to go up in factors of three. So the first DNA he sequenced was a small virus, bacterial virus called PhyX174, and that was about 6,000 base pairs. He then moved to mitochondria, which were 19,000 mm-hmm. base pairs, and then he did another bacterial virus called Lambda, which is 50 mm-hmm. base pairs. And so we thought, well, Fred will be looking for something about 150 for the next thing, but he retired before that. And of course, the next thing of 150 was done by his student, Bart Burrell. I just give you that because that extended over about 10 years, that escalation. If you think about the genome of C. elegans, which the Salston's group, Salston and Waterston, sequenced, that is 100 million base pairs. So we've advanced at a tremendous rate. And that has just been pure technology and organization.
In that connection, though, you recently developed a novel technique for very high throughput sequencing. Could you, in general terms, could you characterize that for us and perhaps indicate how it differs from Fred Sanger's approach?
Well, most sequencing is done by copying the DNA and terminating it randomly at different positions. This results in a set of fragments of different lengths. If you know what's at the end of the fragment, which you can tell, and if you can separate the fragments in lengths, you get a ladder, and that's the sequence. But it requires an electrophoretic separation. And it requires each of these templates to be handled separately, or if together, then by robots. Mm-hmm. The system we invented does not use physical separation. And we decided to miniaturize it completely. So if your unit, let us say, is a 1 centimeter diameter well in a microtiter plate, that's the unit of standard sequencing, our unit is a 5 micron bead,
so it's
which is 1,000 times smaller.
Yes.
In two directions, okay, mm-hmm. So it's 1,000,000 times smaller in area. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so with this idea, we were able to develop a technique to load up the templates, mm-hmm. and that has been followed by a technique in which we can sequence, doesn't matter how many, and we actually sequence 2,000,000 templates at the same time. For the moment, we can only do short lengths of about 20. But that's enough to give each fragment a name, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And then we can use this to do a large number mm-hmm. of, a large amount of sequencing mm-hmm. With sort of few yes. resources.
So the bottom line will be that the rate at which sequence information will be generated will be many-fold greater.
Well, we think that what is going to be, at the moment, high-throughput sequencing is done in a factory mm-hmm. with large numbers of machines, robots, and people. Mm-hmm. We would like to replace the entire factory by one machine,
tiny
which
little
you
device.
Could put on each bench.
On a coffee table, yes.
Yeah, we'd
yes.
like, we compare it to... let us say, the modern PC mm-hmm. and the old valve-driven early
the old
computers,
yes, yes.
Which were in that
sure,
mode.
Sure, sure.
And as I like to say, yes. we'd have two technicians because we need one to make the coffee.
Very nice. One thing that has certainly emerged from the study of the worm, the nematode, has been the realization that the genes expressed in the worm are also expressed in flies, in mice, and in human beings, and have essentially the same function across these many different species. This, of course, provokes the question of what studies of C. elegans may have told us or be telling us about human disease and human dysfunction. Aging, for example, is a subject that's been studied, I think, a little bit in C. elegans.
Well, I think a lot of people are confusing two kinds of function. Mm-hmm. One we could call the molecular function. That is, what does the protein actually do? Mm-hmm. And the other one I think we could call the organismic function. Mm-hmm. And of course, geneticists who classified everything by phenotype originally, that is, worked outside inwards, always thought of organismic function, like tall or short mm-hmm. or green or yellow, in the case of Mendel's plants. And then only through many, many years of work were they able finally to reduce this to the molecular function of one gene. Although they had reduced it to one gene, or one Mendelian factor, mm-hmm. as it was called. Now, of course, we're coming up the other way. So it's no surprise the molecular machinery is the same, because, just putting crudely, why invent something if you've done it already? Why do it again? You don't have to. So the molecular machinery is the same. But I think in the cases where you can look at it, it's very different in its consequences for the organism. So although we have a molecular pathway, the same in flies, worms, and people. Mm-hmm. They have very different values, if I can call it, for the organism. So in flies, this is involved in eye determination. In valves, involved with part of the reproductive system. And in humans, it controls cell growth and therefore is involved in cancer. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that it teaches us anything in terms of the function we really have in mind mm-hmm. when we talk mm-hmm. about
But
function.
It does give us the basic biological insights into the pathways that yeah. generate these functions.
Yeah, the machinery is the same. Yes. And that, of course, has been one of the things about molecular biology that we could have told them it would be the same.
Yes.
But exactly, so it gives us that sort of insight as to how things are built out of all of these components. And, I mean, you have to have a kind of view. For example, let me give you an example. You can take a protein which is involved in sex hormone regulation in us.
Mm-hmm.
That is a progesterone-binding protein, for example, and you can put it in yeast, and it works there, if you put all the things. Now, of course, are we then to say that yeast cells pre-configured this whole evolution, and therefore it's extremely surprising mm-hmm. to find that mm-hmm. this is transportable this way? Or are we to say that within us there is buried kind of deep down a yeast crying to be released and that that yes. evolution just built on.
Adds on.
Because once we were yeast cells or something like yes. them yes. and evolution simply added on and used what was there. Yes. So yes. it's yes. not surprising yes. that we have this kind of core compatibility.
Mm-hmm. In your recent work, you've been analyzing the genome of the fugu, the pufferfish, a great sushi delicacy. How did you choose this model organism?
Well, again, by going to libraries, I discovered in the late 60s that a man called Heingartner had analyzed the DNA content of a large number of fish. And it found that this family of fish had very small DNA contents. And so, of course, at that time, people would have said, well, when there was a kind of belief that, you know, the number of genes you had was proportional to your complexity. So people might have argued, well, that they were 8 times better looking than fish and 8 times smarter. And therefore they deserved 8 times more DNA. But we know you don't advance in complex organisms by inventing new genes. You advance simply by using the same set of genes, but in different ways. And so the idea became clear that if this, as we suspected, had the same number of genes as, let us say, we have, then the genome would be more compact and would contain 8 times less junk because our genomes are laden with junk. Notice I say junk and not garbage because there are 2 kinds of rubbish. There's the rubbish you keep, which we call junk, and the rubbish you throw away, which is called garbage. And this is just rubbish that hasn't been thrown away. I think it's junk. It may prove to be our downfall, but probably not for, let us say, another 100 million years.
I'm glad to know we have a little time.
We have a little time.
But how did this arise? 2 vertebrates, humans, fish, so different in their method of storing information.
Well, I think that there's 2 reasons. One is, A, the fish never got this junk. And that is one of the reasons. Its placental mammals have rather specialized in accumulating all of this junk. Mm. And that's simply because, for a whole lot of complicated reasons, that we needn't go into mm-hmm. for the moment, but I want to point out too that the fish is losing DNA. And the concept that organisms are degenerating in evolution is, I think, rather novel, because we tend to think of everything on the up and up and everything that's around as better than everything that isn't around. And the idea that things are going downhill does not please us. But, for example, the puffer fish that I work on, I think, is losing DNA. It seems to do without some of the genes, and in fact can do without some of the parts of the body. For example, it has no ribs, and that allows it to puff.
Ah, of course, and blow itself up. Yeah. Useful defense mechanism. Yes, yes, yes. You have been known to be a strong believer in ignorance, and it's the importance of ignorance in science. You've made the point that knowing too much is sometimes an impediment to doing creative work. It discourages one from undertaking certain ventures. And I'm reminded of the English critic John Ruskin, who said that to know anything well involves a profound sensation of ignorance. How have you nurtured ignorance in your career?
I think by changing one's field. I think you, after a while in a subject, you begin to know too much, and especially if you're in a position of a teacher of young researchers, you already know too much, and you will say, well, it can't work or it won't work. Mm-hmm. And I think one has to resist this, because sometimes, in fact, more often than not, an idea which, in fact, is so strange to begin with and thought to be very unlikely actually generates some new experiment. And so I think you've got to change your subject. So I tend to,
I move
around.
Yes.
I also think that we also have to be really careful that ignorance does not succeed. See, I once conceived of the individual who worked in what I called the Oklahoma School of Poultry Engineering, and who was ignorant, but because of his ignorance did interesting experiments and made fools of us. And so to prevent him doing this, I used to do OSPE experiments, as I called them, mostly in the dead of night. None of them worked, actually, but then I knew they wouldn't work for him either.
Yes, yes. Our time has really flown by here, and I wish only that we had more time, but I must ask you one final question before we wind up our discussion here this evening, and it's the following. If you had the opportunity to meet and to speak with an almighty deity, and to ask one question that he or she would answer for you, what would that question be?
Well, I have asked that question in another form, but I'd have to think of a different answer now. I think I'd ask as, how the hell can I get out of this place?
Sydney, it's been wonderful having you here this evening. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.